Well, I want to welcome you to Amravati this afternoon. The listed topic for reflection, spiritual beauty, which is something to sometimes these words, both of them, can be seen in very superficial ways. I find it in a spiritual development, one really needs to kind of redefine the meaning of words, because so much of our language is habitual, and oftentimes we use words without appreciating some of the more subtle meanings or values that these convey. So something like the word spiritual can be kind of just the sentiment of the mind, or it can be related to spirits, it can be related to different interpretations of spirits, and beauty is a word that also is used for anything that attracts. But on spiritual plane, when one is developing the life, or say to realize the ultimate reality, then beauty, the word beauty, conveys something that is say truly beautiful, not just say attractive. It's perfectly beautiful. Any beauty in any of its forms then is always a reminder of ultimate reality. Like flowers can be seen as symbolically as that which reminds us of ultimate beauty or truth or goodness. We can regard anything good in our lives, or all that is true, good and beautiful, even though in the aspects that we experience it, it's temporary or impermanent. In its significance, it we can relate it to ultimate realization or perfect beauty, perfect goodness. In the life we live as a sense being, then we're our perceptions that we create around the things that we contact through senses, we can kind of fix them with attitudes and preferences and biases. And when the mind becomes rigid and fixed and kind of paralyzed within just our ability to perceive, then doesn't allow us to a full realization of truth. So with meditation, the aim is to lessen the power of this force of habit, to let it fade away, to relinquish the habitual tendencies, so that our conscious experience and wisdom is then informing us about ultimate or spiritual beauty. We're relating, we're contacting, we're realizing that which is perfect and beautiful, true and good, but not in the sense of a condition anymore. It's a realization of that which is of beyond the condition. The conditioned realm can only point to that, can only, if we meditate upon the conditioned realm and see it in its impermanent characteristic, then that impermanent nature of conditions will take us to that ultimate realization. And when we talk about ultimate realization, then we really have to even give up the words like beauty and goodness and truth, because they still get in the way. But as, say, symbolic pointing at ultimate realization, at perfection, at liberation, in the Christian sense of salvation or enlightenment, these words are the realization of nibbana. These are usually in kind of dynamic terms that convey something that happens, something that is realized, rather than something that is attained or grasped or perceived and can be fixed and held to in any way whatsoever. So the enlightenment is through receptivity and relinquishment, and through non-attachment, that we realize ultimate reality. In this realm, the human realm that we live in, say at this age that we are involved with, the consumer society, as they say, or the materialistic society, or just the attitudes of modern humanity with its technology and its exalting our ability to reason and use rational thought, where the self-interest becomes the important one. We become overly concerned with ourselves. We become inflated. We exaggerate our personalities. And this age is one where we acquire a lot of information about all kinds of things. The available information. Everybody can read and write here in Britain. There's so many possible ways to learn and get information about anything that you could possibly be interested in. But for ultimate realization, all of it has to be relinquished. The Buddhist scriptures included, the conventions, the monastic form, the tradition. And I think this is one thing that is very difficult for people to comprehend, because when we connect relinquishment or abandonment as a kind of negative act, as something of getting rid of, as throwing out, as rejection. And so when we talk of letting go or abandoning or relinquishing even the monastic form or the Buddhist tradition or Buddhist religion or the teachers or whatever that we regard with great reverence and great respect, then the conditioned mind tends to logically see it only as an act of rejection or throwing out, abandoning in the sense of getting rid of. Just like we tend to equate we see that the life we live, we're so identified with our own bodies and our own sense experiences and our own personalities. Conscious, with the consciousness that we have, we give it such a personal, it gets such impact on us as a real person, something that when it dies, that's the end. It's very easy for us to see that when somebody dies, that's the end of them, that's the end of their life, that life is ended. And so death for us, if we're not reflective and not investigating our own experience of life within, before this formation dies, and if we're looking at it in the right way, we examine and investigate it as an experience, as the realities of that we are having within this form, then we begin to see that death is merely the end of of the consciousness in this particular form. We begin to sense, a sense beyond the sense, or an intuition. Something knows that because somebody dies or something ends, that's all right. That's the way of all conditions. That's normal, that's natural, that's the way it should be. Because we no longer relate life to a particular form. Life then doesn't die. Conditions come and go. And the forms change. They are born, they develop, reach their peak, they deteriorate and die. That's the natural sequence of events. But life, that's not the end of life, is it? That's the end of consciousness for that particular form. But when we invest the forms with all the significance, we give them so much significance and importance in our lives, then we do suffer enormously when we lose the forms that we become identified with and attached to. When the things that we empower with our attachments, then when they are separated from us, when they die or they're taken away or disappear, we can only feel loss, because we're not really appreciating life as a whole experience. We're merely depending on various forms for a sense of security and fulfillment through being attached, through being identified, through being related to this form and that form and that condition, that person. There's something in us that also wants to speculate about ultimate reality. People can say, can give it a totally positive quality, that it's the supreme happiness, or it's the happiest of the lot. It's total bliss. It's eternal rapture. And these things, these kind of perceptions, are certainly inspiring to the mind, aren't they? To think that life is just pure bliss, eternal, happy, pleasant, forever and ever. Because our experience of life within this form isn't that way, is it? This form is a form that suffers. This is an experience of suffering, the human state. And so any kind of rapture or joy or happiness that we experience, that tends to create a strong desire to try to get more of it, to try to hang on, to increase it, to enlarge upon it, to hang on to it as long as possible. And then when we lose it, even no matter how long we might be able to hold on or keep that going, it changes, because this realm is one where we experience change. We can't sustain anything in a conscious experience for very long. We have to accept the fact that and this is the way it is in this human state. And the suffering, then, is what the Buddha pointed to. It's something to understand rather than to go around looking for these more blissful experiences as the kind of ultimate religious realization. Just contemplate your own life, just what it is to have a human body. Is it a totally blissful, rapturous experience? And it doesn't take much thought to realize it's that this human body is a very limited form, very sensitive form, and it presents us with a lot of discomfort and pain and unpleasantness. not to put it down and to blame it and think that it should be some other way, but to just admit that this is what human life is about. It's hunger and thirst, and it's aging, it's separation from the loved. It's admittedly we have the other. We have good health and vigor and meeting with the loved and bliss and rapture and joy. This is what we would like to have on a permanent basis. But in this form, the wisdom comes through accepting the suffering that we experience, through understanding it, through a willingness to accept all of it. And what I've found is that there's a joy that springs from up in one's heart when you accept the whole of it, the whole lot of it. The suffering, the good along with the bad along with the good, the failures along with the successes. When you determine to accept the whole of it, then one is no longer thinking that there's something wrong with you, something wrong with me, when say that what we love disappears, or what we depend on for our happiness changes, or moves away from us, separates from us. This total embracing of life, the willingness to experience and to accept pain, suffering, and pleasure and happiness. I mean, those are not so difficult to accept. It's the other side, isn't it, that frighten us, that we resist and that we dread. When we talk about this life being a realm of suffering, that's not a value judgment. That's not putting it down. Sometimes the Buddhists get accused of being negative and pessimistic because they say things like that. They say everything is unsatisfactory. Sape sankharanicha, all conditions are impermanent. All is suffering. And of course, taken on the level of a value judgment, that is a very negative thing to say. In some ways, you're putting down everything. I remember thinking, well, you know, then happiness is suffering, and it sounds like you know, sour grapes. It sounds like, you know, you're just trying to paint everything one color. And dismiss everything by saying it's all miserable, all suffering. But recognize that isn't how the Buddha taught. That might be how you interpret it, or how your mind translates those teachings. But in the practice and realization of truth, the recognition of suffering isn't in any way a judgment against anything. It's merely a realization, an understanding of that of our human state and what to expect from this life in this form. Now, when I expect, say, when I look into the future, say, I think, well, I'm getting older, and the problems that come with that are increasingly more apparent. Things change in many ways that you don't want them to. You can see that this is a time where the whole planet seems to be going through the throes of upheavals, of all kinds of conditions that we no longer can keep under control. The doomsday predictions and the kind of misery that we hear about through the news, or even what we're seeing or what we're experiencing. But not a pessimistic outlook, but recognize that all of this is something to maybe look at in a different way. And this is why I think many of you come to places like this. Why you meditate, why you find some attraction or inclination towards the Buddha's teachings, because intuitively you sense that this might be a way of looking and understanding which will help you to deal with the experiences of your life, which will allow you to learn the lessons you need to learn and get the information you need to have, and help you to respond to life in a way that will be skillful and appropriate rather than just reactive, frightened, bored and weary, threatened and frightened by what you're experiencing or what you hear about or what you see. When we investigate our own human state more and more, when we're watchful and mindful of it, one thing we began with the breath, with just the breathing of your body. And that's such an ordinary thing that we don't give it much significance unless we're having trouble with breathing. If we're asthmatic or something, then each breath is a struggle and is very important to us. But say the normal breathing of just inhalation, exhalation usually goes on we do not feel any interest in it or give it much attention until it becomes painful or uncomfortable. But the breath itself is like a spirit, isn't it? It's a sense of, when we're breathing in, we're breathing, there's a sense of inspiring. This sense of spiritus and breath and that which, say, when we inhale, we think we're bringing into our body the breath. We're filling ourselves up with this spiritus. We're inhaling, and this sense of fullness that we get from inhaling, then when we exhale, there's a sense of fullness and completion, and then the need that this form has and its limitation to exhale. You can't just inhale, you have to exhale. One conditions the other, they depend on each other. Because in this form, this is the way it is. A form like this can only take in so much, and then it has to expel. And this, just this alone, we contemplate the sense of inhaling as an experience, and the experience of exhaling. Both have their lesson to teach us. Something to observe, something to reflect upon, something to try to notice, to note what it is. Now, none of us want to just inhale and not do the other, or just exhale. I mean, that's absurd. And too much of a good thing is usually a disaster. So that when we breathe in the normal way, when we're relaxed and just breathing, letting the breath flow, not trying to make it, force it, trying to control it, manipulate it, trying to hold it, trying to get something out of it, trying to change it or breathe like somebody else or breathe according to a recipe, or when we're no longer caught in some attitude about it, when we're actually just with the normal breathing of our body, then, and we actually relax with that. That is what we call bliss. The sense of a self, of me trying to get something or control something has been relinquished. No longer am I trying to practice anapanasati. No longer am I trying to get samadhi. No longer am I trying to you read the meditation manuals and follow the directions, and you form all kinds of ideas that you have to acquire or get or attain or achieve something in order to experience something that sounds like bliss or peace or concentration. But just the relaxation into the breath as it is, a kind of relinquishment of self into just the being with the flow of your normal breath is blissful. Whenever we do that, we experience bliss. Just on the level of being with our own body breathing. Something as simple as that. And as simple as that might sound, yet our habit tendencies are such that we tend to make it into very kind of enormous effort and complicated thing and difficult attempts we make, the kind of futile attempts we make at this to try to get bliss. So it's not, whenever we practice in order to get bliss or get happiness, we can be rest assured that we're really not going to get it. We might get something for a moment through maybe some fortuitous circumstances, but not through the effort that comes from me trying to get and attain. It's only when we relinquish that desire and forget ourselves and let go of that, that we begin to understand, realize the perfect beauty and goodness and truth that is with us all the time when we no longer are trying to become or trying to get rid of things. Noticed in the monastic community how this kind of language is certainly understood by almost everyone, I'm sure. But yet, in the daily life of the nitty-gritty of life, the things that happen in daily life, how easy it is to forget all that and to get caught up in our trying to become and trying to get rid of, trying to control. Trying to get something we want, trying to get rid of that which we don't like. There's a sense of our own, something's wrong with us. That there's something wrong with me, and I'm not good enough the way I am right now. And I come here to get rid of these faults and these flaws in order to sometime, if I'm lucky and I practice hard enough, then manage to get rid of these defilements, hopefully to attain a blissful state, a peaceful heart, a sense of contentment, and all that we read about and hear about and feel is what we would most like to experience on a continuous basis. Now, in monastic life, because it is aimed at being aware and mindful around the things, the situation, the people you're living with, and the conditions that surround you, you're developing this attentiveness and reflectiveness on the way things are, then after a while you begin to see the futility of your life when it's based on merely trying to attain and achieve and get rid of things. Because, you can do that for so long, and then after a while you just can't do it anymore. You give up. You go through periods where you can't stand meditation, where you can't stand to hear any more Dharma talks or read any more books on Buddhism. And you know, you at one time maybe you were aspiring towards a realization of spiritual beauty, and then through those continuous efforts and disappointment that comes from such efforts, you could care less about spiritual beauty. You'd like to just enjoy worldly beauty or anything that distracts or excites you to get you out of the disappointment or the despair, the disillusionment that you're feeling. So in our meditations, we do have to try and struggle and put forth this effort until we... But the aim is not to say that is what you have to do, because that's what you will do. Most of you will do that. Even with talks like this and all the advice in the world, that will be how you approach it. But encouraging you to reflect upon the result of it by doing all that, by trying too hard, by forcing a situation, or by not bothering, by taking a more, it doesn't matter, you just must be patient and just kind of relax and then fall asleep is what happens. Through reflecting on that, you begin to see the extremes that you of your mind, and through observing and noticing those extremities, you let them go. You have to recognize you have to accept those extremities, recognize them, and through that, then you're the insight into relinquishing them, not in getting rid of, out of aversion, but just seeing there's no need to hang on or to reiterate or duplicate those same things over and over again, because you get the same result, disappointment and despair. And through that reflection on the result of your practice, then more and more you come to the middle, or the point of balance. Recognize that that's how we have to learn, through trial and error, and through being fully aware of the extremities that we go to, and what is an extreme. Some people want a lot of kind of happiness and blissful experiences. They want to get the jhanas. They want to get these highly concentrated states. They want refined conscious experiences. And so that if one's attention is toward attaining and getting these kind of experiences, and you do get them, even when you get them, somehow it's not really what you'd hoped for. When it was really maybe hoping to get them where you could kind of spend long periods of time, you can maybe 7 days at a time in some kind of utterly blissful state, and not have to bother with the coarseness and the trivialities and the banality of our lives as human beings. But that is an extreme, isn't it? We're in our human form. We're not meant to live in that way for very long. We can touch into it. We can have flashes and moments of these kind of states, mental states, ethereal realms, psychic realms, all possibilities within this human form are available to us. But they're flashes, they're moments. And then we find ourselves back here and now with this body, with the breath, with the people we're living with the weather the way it is, with the environment the way it is, having to eat food, prepare food, eat food, get dressed, get undressed, bathe, do all the things that human beings have to do in their lifetime on a day by day. These are normal functions for our human state. So in reflecting on the way it is, we're informing ourselves of our humanity is this way, that the body we have and the realm that we're living in is this, it's this way. Not a matter of liking it, we would maybe like it to be another way, but by recognizing that it's this way, then we accept it, because that's the only sensible thing to do. Imagine spending your life saying, I don't want life to be this way. And that's what many people do. I don't want the world to be the way it is. And I don't want you to be the way you are. And I don't want to be the way I am. I want to be something other than what I am. And I want you to be what I want you to be. And when you're not, I don't want you. And I want Britain to be a certain way. And when it's not, I'm going to just complain about it and blame it on somebody. The planet, it's now great fun during 500 years of the white man's civilizing the world, isn't it? When Christopher Columbus discovered America, it gave the Europeans a chance to express themselves fully in all their wisdom. They went over to the Americas and they managed to destroy other civilizations in no time. And within 500 years, we've definitely proved our superiority, our extremity. And yet, what has that done, you know, with all our conceit and arrogance and even good intentions? Because we can see it in merely pejorative terms, but I'm sure a lot of people thought that this was a good thing, civilizing, converting savages to Christianity, all of this can be seen as a very noble and kind of the white man's burden, the sense of noblesse oblige and all the kind of words and concepts that we can justify what we're doing. And some of it's true. Some of it has been very good, and much of it hasn't. So we find ourselves, you know, trying to create a Christian, maybe Christianize the world, convert everybody to our way of thinking, educating everybody with our cultural attitudes, our language, our way of doing things. And even when we succeed, because it has, in many ways, this is what's happened. English is the most, is an international language now. You go to Buddhist conferences in Korea, what do they speak? English. They can't, you know, they went to the World Fellowship of Buddhists conference several years ago in Seoul. They had to use English. They had Mongolian monks, they had Chinese, they had Taiwanese, Bangladesh, India, Sri Lanka, Thailand, American monks from England, English monks from America, Vietnamese monks from America, Vietnamese monks from France, Vietnamese monks from Vietnam. The real right kind of mixture of potpourri of nationalities and races, and yet the language that had to be used for mass communication was English. Mass media with television, computers, and all the rest is now, say, we know what's happening in Yugoslavia, or what they call the former Yugoslavia. We hear about what's happening in Somalia, and even though people don't know what to do about it, and everybody's saying do something, but nobody quite knows how to do anything, we do hear about it and we do care about it. So our humanity is this way, isn't it? When we say, just like eating and surviving, these basic needs, like in Somalia, they're just trying to survive at the lowest level of survival. And they're not even asking for 3 square meals a day. If they could just get 1 square meal a week, or even it doesn't have to be square. Just something or other in your stomach now and then would be a great improvement. So this is a basic necessity. We have to be fed. We have to cooperate in order to take care of each other's basic needs. And we can see that this is to develop spiritually. We have to have certain foundation for that spiritual development. We do need food, we need shelter, we need medicines for illnesses, we need something to wear, we need basic requisites for survival before we can really think about anything else or find significance in anything spiritual. Because this human body is this way, it needs those kind of things. Otherwise, it becomes too painful, too uncomfortable, too miserable a condition. So our humanity is this way. We're beings that live on this level. We have to have material food. We have to have things just for survival. We need to accept, and not just take it for granted. Here in the Western world, we can just think, "Oh, this is what we have all the time. It's no great problem for us." But yet, in a country like this, we're very fortunate because these basic requisites are easy enough to get. We can just take them for granted, not even bother to think about them or even notice them very much, maybe complain about them when they aren't exactly to the standard that we would like, what we tend to do. But when we're reflecting on what we need for our spiritual development, then we're looking at it in a different way, not from a standard of what we would like, but from what is necessary. That also, we're not going to an extreme. We're learning just the basic needs, the natural needs of our human form for survival, for comfort, for reasonable amount of comfort. So that's wisdom. It's not just going into a state rejecting the body, saying, "I don't want anything more to do with this horrible body," and trying to get into some lovely kind of mental realm where you don't have to feel the hunger or the pain or the discomfort or the heaviness of your human body. That's not the way out of suffering. That's a distraction. That's not the middle way. That is not a way of balance. And yet that's what many people try to do, just try to live in a realm in which they don't have to feel very much. Now notice in a society also, it's not just physical feelings so much, but emotional needs, isn't it? A lot of the suffering that we experience is on the emotional level. We feel resentful, we feel angry, we feel bitter, we feel unloved, we can feel rejected, we can feel jealous and frightened and envious and offended. Living with each other, there's always these kind of emotional reactions. We affect each other very much. Human beings, just we tend to congregate together. Somehow we might think we want to live alone to avoid all this emotional conflict, But we don't really spend all that much time alone, do we? We really like to be with each other. We feel attracted to each other. And yet at the same time, we exasperate, annoy, and irritate each other. The emotions are, I think, a very something that many people don't fully accept and don't understand, because it's a bit embarrassing, isn't it, to have emotions. And to be reasonable is very nice, to be like the kind of wise, reasonable person that says the right things and does, knows what to do in situations and seems to be in control of himself or herself, and that's the what we'd like to be. And yet we find ourselves losing control, kind of breaking down, crying, or just feeling angry over some little slight, or feeling jealous over something, or feeling ourselves as being worthless and unlovable. And these kind of emotions kind of haunt and hang around us. And yet this is also a part of our humanity. These kind of things, these kind of feelings can also be seen as a part of our practice of Dhamma, not just suppressed, denied, rejected, but to be seen in terms of what they really are. That when we integrate these emotions, then that's our energy. It gives us energy and vitality. To live our lives, to develop spiritually. So our emotions, rather than being judged or being controlled or being suppressed, are integrated through mindfulness and through understanding them. And I think that's much of modern psychology is increasingly aware of this, because I think in countries like this that have developed their intellects to a high level and their ability to think and be reasonable and rational, oftentimes at the repression and rejection of the emotions. And so the problems, the suffering that people have is very emotional. And yet these are very important conditions to understand and to integrate into one's experience of life. And how do you do it? You can't just... Emotions are the way they are. You can't say, I want only these kind of emotions. You just get what you happen to get. We'd all like to have wonderful, when we see things, when difficult scenes arise, we'd like to respond in a noble and reasonable, sensible, mature way. And we generally tend to, at least try to, and oftentimes not really admit how we're feeling. It's interesting to see how we can put on a good face, a stiff upper lip, a kind of good front, and maybe look quite good in public, but inside, underneath that, is all kinds of other things that you don't want anyone to know about, and even yourself. And it's those kind of feelings that we need to integrate through accepting them, through mere acceptance, through feeling them, through willing to feel those kind of emotions, which isn't indulging in them, kind of wallowing in them, but go into the actual feeling of them, to feel the suffering or the feeling of anger or feeling of jealousy or fear or rejection or being offended, willing to fully accept that as a feeling, then it integrates into your life. It gives you energy. It helps to balance you, gives you strength and wisdom to be able to keep learning from and using what you're feeling, what you're experiencing for developing the Eightfold Path. Because the Eightfold Path or the Fourth Noble Truth is the way of balance. When we give it the title Eightfold, it does sound complicated. Number eight. What is the first one? What is the fifth one? And so forth. We get tangled up with the folds of the path, when really it means balance, isn't it? It means being able to be here and now, and with what the way it is, and as each one of us is experiencing it. Even if you're in a terrible state right now, you're totally confused and totally miserable, and yet you're accepting that misery. At least maybe you're noticing it. You're willing to feel it. You're willing to have that feeling rather than trying to get rid of it or ignore it. Through that kind of patient endurance and acceptance, then that feeling dissolves. It's impermanent. It disappears. And that is what I say is developing the Eightfold Path, because more and more you feel a sense of balance, of proportion, of confidence, of inner strength. Something in you is, you realize within you is something, is that which is very pure, very beautiful, very good, very true. And it's not just something that's going to change according to the weather or to the age or to the company or the place or whatever that these things do change, and they're always unpredictable. Amaravati, we try being a Buddhist monk, I don't have to do any of the cooking. It's not that I don't want to, because I used to think of myself as a good cook when I was a layman. And I liked cooking. So it's not me kind of shove this duty off onto the Anagarikas or the lay people. It's just the part of the convention of Theravada monasticism. But you hear these reports of what goes on in the kitchen at Amaravati. And most of them aren't all that promising. The food generally quite good, but then the emotions that have gone into making this food sometimes have been anything but good. Because obviously working in a kitchen and having and preparing things and being in charge or being a worker, being something or other, will bring up various feelings of that one has, you know, about being say if you have somebody who's an expert professional cook, and they're asked to go and help the chief cook who might be an amateur, not a very good cook. Then the professional cook can get very offended by what they see the head cook doing. Or people have various views about how to cook food and what the Sangha should have. And other people have, you know, this is a very fraught subject. When you get into food, the passions are easily aroused. Food brings up all kinds of emotions.
So it is, it can be seen as an opportunity to learn and to resolve these kind of emotions. This is what I've been trying to encourage the cooks here at Amravati to do. I don't know if they believe me or not, but it certainly, you know, even though they were, I just want to get out of the kitchen and go off to the retreat center and have some space, fair enough. But that's not really what you need to do, maybe. If you really can't cope with the kitchen, then recognize the kitchen may be something that you need to investigate more and learn how to accept and to resolve your feelings, the hot passions, emotions that are aroused through those kind of duties or that kind of activity. When we do that, then we find out we really learn and strengthen ourselves in these kind of through doing these kind of ordinary things. The danger is to think, well, I want to become a monk or a sila drawer. I don't have to do this anymore because it interferes with my practice. And the way of getting out of it, avoiding it. It's not spiritual. Cooking food is mundane. It brings up all kinds of worldly emotions. It's a hassle. And I just can hardly wait till they give me the higher ordinations where I can get out of that kitchen, go in and do a puja now and then, kind of chant a nice mantra over the stove, and then get out and let them go to it. Because that is wanting to get away from something rather than seeing that desire to get away is the real problem. Or wanting something, to have the feelings you have when you're when you're working in the kitchen. Notice that in your own lives, whatever work you do and people you're living with, you can begin to at least notice what you're feeling, not judging what you're feeling, but beginning to notice it feels this way. There's this kind of feeling in my mind. It feels like this. And by that kind of reflection, then you, something in you feels it's all right then to feel that way. It's okay. Everything is all right. You don't have to control and manipulate. You don't have to kind of spend all your time trying to get something or get rid of something. You have more confidence in just being with your life in whatever conditions, whatever forms that you happen to be with in the here and the now. Being a head monk, for example, it's working through the kind of emotions that come from having responsibilities and everybody and you know, wanting to do a good job and be responsible and not make a mess of it. And all these kind of feelings come up in the mind, and then you begin to accept those feelings. And then when you do make a mess of things, that's okay too. You can accept the feelings of responsibility. You can accept the feelings of failing, you can accept the feelings of that come from disappointing other people. Because, you know, one doesn't want to disappoint. One wants to encourage faith in people that come here so that they have trust and faith in the Sangha and in Buddhism, and they'll practice it and develop. It's all very good stuff. But inevitably people get disillusioned and you disappoint them. But that's all right too. Because if that's what you feel, the feeling that people have been disappointed with you, then it feels this way. It feels just this way. And then in that reflection, that feeling is integrated. It's energizing you. It gives you effort to keep going. Where if you get caught in in self-pity or resentment, then you're shutting yourself off again. You're going to get weak and sickly and enervated and depressed because you're closing yourself down. You're not the things that you're feeling are not being integrated. They're merely being controlled, and that control will always weaken you and make you feel tired and fed up and despairing and exhausted. Just thinking negatively, even after a good night's rest, can make you feel totally exhausted. I can think totally exhausting thoughts that when I think them, I'm totally exhausted at that moment. Even though I'm not totally exhausted, I'm totally exhausted. That's the power of thought. And it is powerful. Our thoughts are very powerful. So don't, you know, what you do think is to be recognized and to be accepted rather than judged, controlled, suppressed, exaggerated, all the rest of it that is the madness that goes on in this human realm. So I think that's enough for the formal talk this afternoon, and time for tea, 3:05. Invite you all for a cup of tea, and then in about 15 minutes we can reassemble for questions.